Why is it important to take a greater perspective that isn't centered around yourself when we're considering problems and events happening around us? Why is it important to not center the world around yourself, but instead scope out to the relationships you've built and the web that coalesces to describe your world? And why is it important for us to take a look at the concept of a monotheistic one Lord over creator, as opposed to multiple polytheistic ways of life, as a potential philosophy to consider and value? Hello, and welcome back to Stoic Spirituality, a podcast where I look through, analyze, and dissect various books and philosophies I've thought about or read over the last few years. My name is Jagan, and I'm a student of the human experience trying to spread some knowledge out to the rest of the world. So, in previous episodes, we discussed philosophies such as Stoicism and a little bit of strategy, and then we also went through the Bhagavad Gita. So I'm going to continue in this episode on an adventure through the Yoga of Knowledge, Chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, where we set up from last two episodes ago, where Arjuna sat completely broken in this state of grief, anxiety, and pity, and despondency, trying to figure out what he wanted to do, and how he was going to throw away all his weapons, because he felt that he couldn't bring himself to do what is right. And a few points from the two episodes ago to consider are that if he was really pacifist, he would have considered all of these costs prior to taking up his arms and starting the battlefield. And more often than not, he was just overwhelmed by emotion, something we're all sometimes relatable and guilty of, causing us to perverse the way the world actually flows and tune it to our own flawed perception. And a lot of Stoicism talks about viewing the world objectively. And Arjuna, in the end of chapter 1, is the foremost example of someone who has forsaken the subjective view of the world and instead seen it through these heavily tinted lens of his own self-pity, forsaking his dharma and looking at the world in the lens of his own misery and his own ego. So now, to start off the chapter, we're going to look at verse by verse, with a little bit of analysis for each illustration or each verse. So in verse 1, Sanjaya pretty much says to Dhritarashtra, who's the blind king overseeing and hearing this entire story from his lips, that to him who was overcome with such pity and despondency, with eyes full of tears and agitated, Madhusudana, who is another word for Krishna, spoke these words. So in this setting, we have Arjuna, who's on the ground, thrown away his weapons, and kind of immersed in this world of pity and misery, not knowing what to do, but knowing that he will not fight because he should be peaceful. How will he be able to bear the sins of killing those he has grown up with and those uncles and people he has revered as mentors? And so Krishna responds in the next verse, where is his perilous condition come from? Where is this pity and despondency come from? This dejection, this un-Aryan-like, Aryan referring to the Aryan race who came into India, heaven excluding and disgraceful Arjuna. So you can kind of see that in this case, what Krishna is trying to do is he's trying to point out all of these various qualities that lay in stark contrast to how Arjuna should be as a person, or rather what his dharma requires out of him. This dejection that he pulls out illustrates the complete lack of morality, or like the lack of viewing the world objectively. This heaven excluding disgraceful are more words used to stir him out of his misery or his self-pity and anxiety that has resulted from seeing all of his mentors lined up in front of him. And just all of this phrasing is meant to illustrate the kind of discrepancy between how he should be and how he is, and even how he was before the battle began, or the battle was to begin, and how he is now that he's staring at everyone who he's about to kill. And so, a little bit of philosophical analysis on this. One thing to kind of understand is that in our lives, one common thing that is going to be there is change. And change will be accompanied by bumpy roads, will be accompanied by people having problems with what you're saying or what you're doing. It'll be accompanied by many sources of stimuli that you're not expecting or that are meant to throw you off and make you take a step back. And what's important here is that everything depends not on your avoidance of the suffering, but rather in your dexterity in steering yourself along these bumpy roads of life. Because if you try to live in this bubble where you think everything is good, or you think nothing's going to happen to you, life will kick you down that slope very quickly, or almost immediately. Because as much as we like it or not, all of us go through our own journeys, and our journeys are marked by suffering. And that suffering is what really makes us who we are. It adds these defining characteristics to mold us into someone capable of empathy and sympathy, and being someone that people can trust. If you were to live an idealistic life where nothing bad happens to us, that kind of life would not give us any moral qualities or any moral compass. Because as much as we can extract from books, experience has a far longer lasting impact, at least initially for us, in our quest to live this life to its fullest. And another thing is, someone who refuses to take risks is also someone who is far less likely to find themselves in situations where potential suffering could occur, or where they could feel uncomfortable or out of their comfort zone. And what this kind of illustration is to provide is that your dexterity in handling situations that will arise, that will threaten to throw you off balance, is what defines your life. And what defines an intelligent person is their ability to deflect and to take in and to adapt to any situation that arises. So now, continuing on with verse 3 and 4, Krishna continues his kind of belittling or almost deriding of Arjuna's current state, while using stirring words to kind of lift him off the ground, metaphorically speaking. So he says, "Yield not to impotence, because it does not befit thee. Cast off this weakness of your heart and stand up." And so one important part of Indian mythology in general is that when one person, they have their regular name, like Arjuna, but usually they are given many other names. Like, for instance, O Scorcher of Foes, which is the translation of a Sanskrit word, was also one of the many names that Arjuna was given. And so this kind of covers verse 3, where Krishna continues to half belittle and half almost make Arjuna rise from this severely broken, quote-unquote, state that he is currently in. And so now verse 4, Arjuna responds, "So how, O Madhusudana," which is another word for Krishna, "shall I, in battle, fight with arrows against Bhishma and Drona, who are my mentors and who are fit to be worshipped?" So you can see here that Arjuna's loop back to his state of pity and despair, where he refuses to acknowledge the kind of overall fight that is happening around him, and instead looks at his own ego. A lot of us look at all of our problems through our individual ego. How does this affect me? How do I get affected by this? Or how does this decision affect me? But rather, look at what you're championing, or look at the world from a bigger scale. if something happens to you and something that you were not expecting does happen to you, think of the overall ideology or cause that you were championing and kind of look for what you are trying to build up in yourself. And then ask yourself, not looking at it through your individual self-interest, but the overall world self-interest, if this is really something bad for you. Marcus Aurelius in Meditations talks about, look at things that happen to you that may affect you negatively, but also consider the benefit for nature. And if something is beneficial to nature, which in this case refers to the entire world, province, or however you want to phrase it, was it really bad for you? So in this case, Arjuna will be forced to commit these actions out of his own dharma for the sake of the entire world. But when he looks at it through his individual ego and his individual problems, it is seemingly something that has a lot of negative effects and something he does not want to do because he thinks that it is wrong. So our egoistic self can cause a lot of moral confusion and misconceptions, particularly if we're emotionally not the most stable we could be, which Arjuna is in this case. He has not scoped out or zoomed out to see the bigger plan, the bigger scale, what is happening around him, and instead localizes it or granularizes it to just the single event happening at that time. And so, by allowing yourself just even today to not kind of focus or zoom in on just the effects of something on yourself, but instead by zooming out and looking at the grander scale of things, asking yourself if this little event that happened to me that threw me off balance is going to have more harm or good in the long run, not only for me, but for a bigger scale, you can find yourself looking at everything more objectively without letting your emotions and your ego cloud your judgment. And remember, there is the idea that you are the person that is not the mind, but the awareness behind the mind. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Hindu mythology, and other mythology, this is called the self. Not the ego or the mind, but the person behind it is referred to as the self. And so perfect mortality in the Bhagavad Gita can be declared and lived by whoever seeks to throw off this egoic delusion, controlled primarily by the mind, and by one who seeks to live and discover his identity in his self, in the one beyond the mind, in the one who is the awareness. And so Arjuna then continues in verse 5, better indeed in this world is to eat even the bread of beggars than to slay the most noble of teachers. And even if I kill them, my enjoyments of wealth and desires will be stained with blood. So you can see kind of the continuation of what we talked about before, where Arjuna's individual ego has clouded the rest of his judgment. Under his dharma and under the plan of the one above, who is represented by Krishna in an avatar, there is meant to be a battle to cleanse the field, to cleanse the nation right now, to bring about change in the longer future. There is a plan. And there is also the dharma of each warrior who has taken up their arms, which is to fight the other side to claim victory. From a dharmic kind of karmic defining illustration, this is what must happen. However, as you can see by Arjuna's staining of blood, quote, that his ego is what's driving his sentiment or his ideology, not the overlooking dharmic purpose or the overall plan that the one above has, but a singular clouded ego. Just think of it in our regular lives. When was the last time you misread a situation or misfired a kind of accusation. Would you not say that when you were looking at the situation subjectively, your sentiments and emotions clouded your understanding? Your ego forced you to perverse the way you were looking at a situation from an objective standpoint to a subjective one, using confirmation bias to continually feed upon what you thought was right? In this case, we too will then act like Arjuna did, in a state of clouded judgment, may it be from pity, misery, victimhood, or whatever name you want to call it. From this objective point of view, we act, instead of allowing ourselves to see the grander scale of things from an objective standpoint. And so, he continues, because Arjuna is in this state of immense despair, which sets the tone for the Bhagavad Gita, where he is so broken by the fact that his individual arms will have to do a lot of the killing, not knowing that he's only an instrument of the one above, he stands there, completely despondent. And he continues, I can scarcely say which will be better, that we should conquer them or they should conquer us. Them and us, referring to the Kauravas, the 100 brothers that are the villains, quote unquote, of this story, or the Pandavas, who are the 5 brothers, who are fighting for their share of the kingdom. Even the sons of Dhritarashtra, after slaying whom you do not wish to live, stand facing us. Remember, when our mind does not function with ourself, and it is clouded by the maya, the illusion, the ego, the dukkha from Buddhism, we shatter our own individual personality. We shatter the inner world inside of us, and instead give in to these delusions of grandeur, delusions of the world circling around us, and delusions of what is right from a subjective, very flawed point of view. And so, Arjuna says, my heart is overpowered by the taint of pity. My mind is confused as to what my duty should be. And he kind of, at this point, decides to proclaim himself as a student to Madhusudana of Krishna, his teacher, begging him, asking him to tell him decisively what is good for me. He proclaims himself as a disciple to the Lord and requests his understanding and instruction, taking refuge in Bhagavan. Because he recognizes finally that the sorrow that he will accumulate will not be depleted or gotten rid of, even if he should attain prosperous and unrivaled dominion on earth or lordship over the gods. And saying that, giving up his weapons, throwing them on the ground, once more, he says, I will not fight, and just sits there. And so one definition of dharma that we're all used to is the definition of it being our purpose. A lot of books, a lot of modernized Hindu mythology, talks a lot about the idea of dharma being our purpose, what drives us or what strives us. But the Bhagavad Gita takes a more tied in, per se, definition of what dharma is. Dharma in the Bhagavad Gita is defined as the nature of what makes a thing itself. It's not a purpose which is done by actions, but it is the defining nature of something that is what is defined as dharma. And so we can kind of see a bit of a, almost in a sense, imagery / extended metaphor for what's happening in this battlefield. The ego, which is represented by Arjuna, sits back in his chariot, which is in this case the body, and has thrown down all instruments of egocentric activities, which in this case is his weapons. The sense organs, which are the horses, are all held back by the mind, which are the reins, and the charioteer, in this case, which is Krishna, or the intellect, lends to the ego a divine strength with its guide to triumph over adharma, or ego-clouded, egocentric activities. And so for us as human beings, we must follow through with the same extended metaphor. We must allow ourselves or allow our ego or force our ego to sit back in our body. Throw down all of our instruments of egocentric activities, desire-based activities that are not fixated on a goal without worry for the future or the fruits of our actions. And we must allow ourselves to be reined in, or rather rein in our sense organs with our mind, and allow our intellect to give the ego divine strength to be channeled in toward contemplation of the self, triumphing over adharma, and instead following the path of dharma. And so this kind of ends a bit of Arjuna speaking and begins the philosophical part of chapter 2, which is where Krishna starts talking about the pure self versus the ego, worrying about those you should not grieve for, and understanding the spiritual considerations of people as opposed to the physical. So, Krishna starts off by saying, you have grieved for those that should not be grieved for, and yet you speak words of wisdom. The wise grieve neither for the living nor for the dead. A few concepts to understand. In Hinduism, there is the idea of our soul versus that of our body. So, in Hinduistic philosophy, our soul cannot be damaged by any physical actions that are happening to us. Our soul is a part of ourselves that is inside, imbued deeply inside of us. And then there is our body. Our body kind of is like our ego. And our soul kind of treats our body like a pair of clothes. Through the concept of reincarnation, which refers to the idea of rebirthing multiple times, until you reach moksha or liberation, our soul puts on a body like a new pair of clothes, tries to whittle away the karmic energy that it has gathered throughout its many lifetimes, get to a zero sum, and attain liberation or moksha. So in this case, why Krishna says the wise grieve neither for the living nor for the dead is because they aren't really, in this case, spiritually dead. Their physical body has died, but their soul still lives. Our physical manifestation of the world we see them in has departed, but their soul, which is still seeking liberation, still continues to live. And so in future episodes, we're going to go more into the idea of the soul, how our ego rises when the self is not recognized, along with egocentric ideas, and the idea of the intellect, and how we must differentiate between the ego, the intellect, and the self, using methods such as the three gunas, and drawing from other philosophies such as the power of now and the untethered soul. And so I'm going to spend the last few minutes of this episode introducing the concept of Advaita Vedanta, or non-duality. The idea that there is just one creator that kind of manifests and cannot be described in words, but can be given attributes. And so in this Advaita Vedantic philosophy, this person is called Brahman. Not even a person, but just a state, or just a creator above that cannot be given a word to fully describe them, is referred to in a way we can understand as Brahman. And so this Brahman is also a state of being, where all these subject-object distinctions in our life are obliterated, everything is snapped together, and it's a name, rather for the experience of being. There is no he, there is no it, but there is just an infinite state of being. And so Advaitins, which are people who believe in this idea of Advaitic Vedantic philosophy, talk about Brahma or call Brahma a Sachidananda. Once again, Sachidananda is a term that is used to describe him but cannot be encompassed as his nameless, formless figure. And so Sachidananda refers to three parts: Sat, which is being, or the concept of unity; Chit, which is consciousness, or the principle of awareness that informs the being, referring to the unchanging witness of our being; or Ananda, bliss, joyous being, pointing to the principle of value that the Brahman experience kind of cuts out all partial value. These aren't attributes, but terms that seek to provide a man-made understanding of the Brahman experience. Overall, Brahman is just the fullness of being that enlightens and provides joy with the basis in experience, which is the goal of human life. A lot of our egocentric activities are stuck in our own body and in our own mind, but the idea of Brahman is the idea of the awareness behind the mind, and an experience where we are so present and so still that we do not think any thoughts. And so, to kind of reach to this state, we must understand that it is not something we can intellectualize or use our mind to figure out, but it is something we must experience. And that sounds counterintuitive, because from the way we think about everything, it all seems and all requires to be rational. But God as a concept cannot be envisioned in its pure form by our mind. We can only seek to capture a part of this divine cosmic essence in many forms we take a look at from all religions. May it be Jesus, may it be Shiva, may it be the Buddha, or may it be any other form that we seek to provide or try to allow ourselves to perceive to completeness. But these are only characteristics, or rather terms to provide for understanding, but in no way describe something that cannot be described. Thank you so much for listening to this episode on the idea of the Bhagavad Gita. The first 10 verses, as you walk through Arjuna's despondency, as he refuses to accept his dharma, throwing away his weapons, and being so immersed in a subjective view fueled by his ego that he refuses to see reality, along with a bit of a dip into Advaitic Vedantic philosophy. Over the next few episodes, we'll look into the idea of grand strategy and continue our adventures into the Bhagavad Gita, talking more philosophically about the idea of reincarnation and the idea that our soul cannot be harmed by the physical actions that we take or that happen to us, and the idea of the Brahman from Advaitic Vedantic philosophy. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to hear more content, feel free to drop me a follow at Stoic Spirituality on TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. And feel free to drop a follow on whichever platform you're listening to on. And leave a review if you'd like to see some feedback or some things change in the future. Thank you so much for listening, and see you guys next time.